You're listening to Sunday Extra on ABCRN. I'm Hugh Remington. Thanks for your company. Now, 3 years ago, a British aid worker operating in the Kurdish regions of northern Iraq found herself drawn into the stories of a group of Yazidi women. Yazidis are an ethno-religious minority group. They are frequently persecuted because of their particular religious beliefs. And when the so-called Islamic State was at its brief height, Yazidis were targeted by them for murder, displacement, abduction, and slavery. The women were frequently taken and traded and routinely abused in the worst of ways. But the British aid worker found a particular group of women in a camp who corroborated each other's stories of being enslaved by one man. He was an Australian. The aid worker is Taban Suresh, and she has come to Sydney in a quest for legal justice for these women. Taban, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
How did you find these women?
So we have women and girl centres in refugee camps, and we have three at the moment in northern Iraq in different refugee camps. And these centres provide education, livelihood skills, mental health wellbeing programmes, and we come across a lot of women. And we're very, very close to the women, so we get to hear their stories. And when I heard about our first client, it was a very different story. At that time, never really heard about foreign fighters. Now they are hitting the headlines. But 3 years ago, it was very rare. And for me, as soon as I heard it, I went back to our pro bono lawyers to figure out if there was something that we could do.
What kind of story were the women telling you?
You know, there are different stories. All of them were abducted. Some had had family members killed, slavery, trafficking. Some had been raped. Some had been abused. So it's various stories from different women. Every human rights violation that you can think of. So it's very varied, but all very traumatic.
And where did the Australian connection come in?
So the group of women were held by a foreign fighter, and that foreign fighter was Australian.
And as you listened to their stories, you had no doubt that they were speaking the truth?
Completely, yeah. I mean, they wouldn't, you know, there's no reason for them to lie about who their captors were. They simply described what had happened and gone through their story, and that person just happened to be an Australian foreign fighter.
So you were able to get them to corroborate their stories to build up a picture of what life was like for these women. How many women do you think were involved in this?
There were at least seven women, and we've taken testimonies from a few of them.
And they all have the same story of being enslaved by the same Australian man?
They all have stories of being held by the Australian man.
And the Australian man, I know you don't like mentioning his name, but it's Khaled Sharouf, the man from Sydney who went across there to be a fighter for ISIS.
It's a foreign fighter. I'd prefer not to give him any airtime, but yeah.
And so you don't want to give him a name because you don't want to in any way glorify him. That's what it's about. It's not because you've got any doubt about who the person is.
Exactly. I think they've had a lot of airtime. They've had a lot of coverage. And it's time for the victim stories to be heard.
And so what is your hope in coming to Sydney? You've got pro bono lawyers. What are you trying to do?
So 3 years ago, when we came across the case, for me, it was very important to figure out a practical, tangible solution where we could help the women. There were lots of initiatives that were going on, but as a genocide survivor from Saddam Hussein's era 30 years ago, nothing has really happened for me in terms of recognition. So it was very important that whatever we could do would be some sort of practical, tangible solution whereby some form of justice was implemented. And as we looked through the system, we found ourselves looking at the compensation route, so civil litigation. This doesn't currently exist under the legislations that we're trying to push forward. And we're hoping that we can try and achieve compensation for the women at the state level.
So this is under the laws of Australia that you can get them compensated here for the crimes of an Australian foreign fighter overseas?
Yes, but currently under the current legislation, for jurisdiction reasons, they're not entitled. So I guess the hearing would allow us to know whether they are entitled to apply, considering they're not from this jurisdiction, but we're trying to see if the nexus of the perpetrator being from this region would apply.
So is your ultimate goal to get essentially the Australian state or the state of New South Wales to, through taxpayer funds, pay compensation to the victims of this foreign fighters' terrorist acts in Syria and Iraq?
No. I think that's the misconception. What we are trying to highlight is that there's a massive need and a massive gap legally for victims like the women that we represent. And what we're hoping for, the second part of that, is the frozen assets or the seized assets of foreign fighters to be collectively sold and repurposed and redistributed through the victims' compensation scheme, thereby the money that goes to the women is not through the taxpayers' money. It's through assets that are sold from the perpetrators.
So if someone out there is inspired to become a foreign fighter and head off and do terrible things in the Middle East and elsewhere, then what you're trying to create is a circumstance by which they should know when they go there that assets will be seized and will be used in time, potentially, to compensate the victims of their own criminality.
Yes, and it's also a preventative measure. And we're hoping that, you know, the Australian government will see this as an opportunity for Australia to lead the way. Our first case happens to be by an Australian perpetrator, and there is a gap. And if Australia manages to lead the way in implementing this, it's a massive, massive step forward, not only to give recognition and justice to the women that have faced such crimes, but also it's also a preventative measure for anyone thinking of joining groups.
A deterrent effect, essentially.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are all kinds of complex reasons being suggested as to why people go off and join these kinds of organisations. And so to make an effective deterrent, you have to get at them in some way. What's the advantage that something about their sense of themselves as heroes in their own community can be punctured if people who are depending on them in Australia recognise that their assets could be seized, they could be left poor as a consequence of their choices?
I think so. I think people always think twice once finances are affected in any way. So I think it'll give anyone thinking about it a second thought if they know that assets that's theirs or their families or anyone that could be impacted. So in that respect, if finances are impacted, then I think people will think twice.
So I get the sense that you've got a legal process on foot, but really what you're hoping for is political change.
Yes. There is a gap. There's a lot of moral outcry where there should be justice for these victims. But I think what everyone's slowly realising is there's a massive legal gap as well. And for that legal gap to be filled and for that void to be filled, you do need policy change, you need legislative change. And so political will is needed at that level as well.
You mentioned that you were a victim of genocide yourself under Saddam Hussein. Tell me about that.
So at the age of four, I was a child political prisoner. We escaped being buried alive as a family. My father was poisoned by people that he'd hired from Saddam Hussein. And this was all because I was Kurdish and my father was a poet and a Peshmerga, and so politically active at that time. So we've actually seen firsthand and felt what it's like to be persecuted. And for me, I think witnessing what happened with the Yazidis, it was surreal that I'd survived a genocide, but also witnessed another one. For that reason, I'm so determined to set some form of justice in place whereby history doesn't repeat itself again.
What do you mean you were going to be buried alive?
Quite literally. I mean, we were in prison and our names were called and we were rounded up onto buses. There were two diggers in front of the buses, and the way that they would bury people alive was, you know, I was a child, so I didn't know what was going on. But the adults all knew that you've got two diggers in front of the buses, and the diggers are to dig the holes in front of you, throw everyone in alive. And then what they would do at that time was shovel soil over you as slowly as possible. So it was a slow form of torture. And actually, you know, when I went back to Sinjar and witnessed some of the mass graves, it brings things back to you from your childhood, and you remember actually that could have been us quite easily.
How did you escape?
So we had two drivers, so there must have been some sort of deal that had happened where the drivers changed, and the second set of drivers were Kurdish, so they were actually sent to rescue us. They made a deal with the other drivers, and so when we drove on and they opened the doors and said, "We're Kurdish, we're not going to kill you, but you need to disappear as if you're dead." And after that, we went into hiding for 3 months, and my mum put her foot down and said, "We need to get out of this country because we've got the death sentence on us." So we spent 12 months fleeing from village to village, but this was during the Iran and Iraq war, and so all the bombs were being dropped in the rural regions. So not only were we trying to survive not being killed by the bombs, but we were trying to survive by not being killed by Saddam Hussein.
And somehow you found your way to Britain.
Yes. And it wasn't planned to go there, but my father was poisoned. And so when he was poisoned, he was flown into Iran. We'd got there before him, and he had been poisoned enough where he was paralyzed and he was critical. And Amnesty International had picked up on the story and flew him to the UK for medical treatment. And we had to wait for him to survive, and joined him a year later.
What an extraordinary story. I can see why you're so motivated to try to make things right for these women. How are the women in these camps, these Yazidi women who you deal with, who through your own NGO, your own aid agency, you're now helping these women? What are their prospects for life, for ever returning home, for ever having a normal life?
There's, you know, we support Yazidi women and other women in different regions. So we support them in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan region. We support them in different parts of Europe and different parts of the world. And they're all very, very different. So the ones that are in the camp, you know, life in the camp for any woman or girl is they don't have much prospect. They need an excuse to come out of their tent or their cabins. And so our women and girl centres are a safe social space for them to go and meet other women, to learn new skills. They've been there for 5 years. They're going to be there for a few more years. And so that time, you need that daily contact of actually still learning skills. And they're, you know, the main breadwinners of the family have gone, so they are now earning an income through the skills that they've learned. And the other women that we help in other parts of the world will help them with reintegration programs. So it's different. We try and trigger hope in different ways according to what's needed in that region.
And when you talk to these women, particularly with your own personal history in it, how do you not despair that this region has through generations produced such terrible suffering, particularly for the women, not exclusively to the women, but particularly for the women?
I think we're very, very close to the women. Like on a community level, we're very close to them. And actually, what I've realized is that we're extremely resilient. Like we've had, you know, our region has had years and years of conflict and war. We are extremely resilient, very strong. As long as we've got the support network to support each other, then we are able to come out of it. So I guess it's helping each other.
Mm. Well, good luck in your legal quest coming all the way over here. And I hope there is some justice that comes back towards those women so badly handled by that Australian.
Thank you so much. I hope so too.
Thank you, Taban.
Thank you.